This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, six American soldiers are killed in an Afghan suicide bombing. A U.S. Republican presidential contender drops out. New research finds what's behind the Christmas spirit.
When you have a reaction to Christmas and decorations around you and the scenery you're looking at, there definitely is something that happens. We're able to catch it on scanner.
And if you cannot get enough of Star Wars, we'll tell you how you can own a piece of it. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Washington now confirms that six U.S. service members were killed by a suicide bomber on a motorcycle Monday in an attack on a NATO patrol near Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. The Taliban is claiming responsibility for the attack, which also wounded two other U.S. service members and a contractor. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter, who visited the Bagram base just last Friday, called it a painful reminder of the dangers U.S. troops face in Afghanistan every day. Secretary Carter has warned of a deteriorating security environment, noting that in the year after the NATO combat mission ended, Afghan security forces have suffered over 5,000 casualties, and that the Islamic State was making inroads with up to 3,000 fighters. South Asia analyst Jonah Blank of the RAND Corporation spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty about the troubles in southern Helmand Province.
Helmand has been an unsettled province for much of the period since the Taliban's initial ouster in late 2001. And at various points, parts of Helmand have been some of the most contested and most Taliban-intensive parts of Afghanistan. In fact, just earlier this year, in August, at the very end of August 2015, the Taliban briefly took over the district of Musakala. This is important because during the earlier part of the coalition presence, the Taliban had held Musakala for about a year before they were eventually ousted by the British.
According to reports, since Thursday, there have been 90 casualties near Gureshk, a junction on Highway 1 near the provincial capital of Lashkargah.
These reports have been pretty widely authenticated, although we don't know for sure whether the number is right. It's a pretty high number, though. And Lashkargah is not only the provincial capital, but also the center of gravity for the entire province.
In his Facebook post, Mohammed John Rasulyar said, quote, "We don't provide food and ammunition to our forces on time, don't evacuate our wounded and dead from the battlefield, and foreign forces only watch the situation from their bases and don't provide support." There are reports, although not confirmed by NATO, that U.S. Special Forces have reportedly taken part in the fighting.
Those reports have been put forward from a number of sources. They're unconfirmed, but it's usual practice for NATO and particularly for the U.S. not to confirm the presence of special operations forces. As for the complaints that the deputy governor has made, these are pretty common complaints throughout Afghanistan. Lack of timely pay, particularly lack of medevac, air support, particularly helicopters, get wounded Afghan soldiers off the battlefield and to a hospital in time to save their lives. These are very common complaints, and they have a terrible impact on morale.
Jonah Blank says Afghan security forces lack adequate air support for their ground operations, and morale is hit hard by the fact that Afghan forces lack little or no medevac capability, giving the average soldier little hope he'll be cared for if he is wounded. Jonah Blank is a South Asia analyst with the RAND Corporation. He was speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. The social media reaction to the deaths of the six American soldiers is, as expected, somber. Three Republican presidential contenders have Twittered their thoughts. Dr. Ben Carson at Real Ben Carson said, "My thoughts and prayers are with the family and friends of the American service members who were killed in the suicide bombing in Afghanistan." Florida Senator Marco Rubio posted at Marco Rubio tweeted, "I am deeply saddened by the loss of American service members in a suicide bombing near the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan." Kentucky Senator and presidential hopeful Rand Paul, at Rand Paul, added, "My thoughts and prayers are with the soldiers in Afghanistan who died in today's Taliban bombing." Others, like Sean, at Sean McBride 10, commented, "Six brothers dead in Afghanistan today after a suicide bombing. Makes me sick." And former U.S. Congressman Joe Walsh, at Walsh Freedom, tweeted just one word, prayers. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. The race for the Republican U.S. presidential nomination is now smaller. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina dropped out Monday, acknowledging that he was winning little political support. His departure cuts the field of Republican contenders to 13. Senator Graham is a longtime advocate for a robust American military presence overseas. I spoke with VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone about what the decision to quit the race could mean.
Well, Lindsey Graham was not drawing much support in public opinion polls. In fact, he was drawing so little that he never even made the main debate stage and was relegated to these so-called undercard debates, where he did very well. He presented himself with humor, with conviction, and he was really the preeminent national security hawk in the Republican field. He openly advocated to send large numbers of U.S. troops back into Iraq and also into Syria to try to settle the civil war there and take care of Islamic State. So Graham's departure will kind of take that hawkish voice out of the field, but the practical impact, I don't see much there. He simply was not drawing much support in the polls.
The hawkish positions he held are being expressed by many of the other candidates. Can they pick up from this or anything from him?
Some of them would like to. Lindsey Graham may have a voice when the race turns to the South Carolina primary later in February. Usually that's an important race in the Republican field. And a number of contenders already are expressing the hope they might get his endorsement when it comes to South Carolina voters. I think one in particular who's looking for that might be Florida Senator Marco Rubio. He's worked with Graham in the Senate, but also he's trying to position himself as one of the preeminent foreign policy experts in the Republican field, arguing for a tougher stance against Islamic State, the need for some U.S. ground forces, though primarily he would advocate a coalition of ground forces from Muslim nations, and of course an intensified air campaign. So Rubio is probably the one now hoping to pick up whatever support Graham may have had.
Why do you think some of these lesser candidates continue?
Good question. I think there's still a feeling in many of the campaigns that there's so much uncertainty about where things are headed as we look at 2016. The race is really just starting. We've had a lot of polls. We see how well Donald Trump is doing. But we also see the rise and somewhat the fall of someone like Ben Carson. So I think for a lot of these campaigns, there are lessons there. They believe if they hang in long enough to see how it starts to sort itself out when the voting begins, you know, they might have a chance. That's why someone like Jeb Bush is perhaps hanging in there. Ohio Governor John Kasich. Certainly New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who's seen his polling numbers go up in the early state of New Hampshire of late. So in some ways, even though a lot of these folks may not seem to have much of a chance, they don't see a reason to get out because many of them aren't convinced that in the end, Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Thank you, Ray.
VOA's senior political correspondent Jim Malone. State-by-state Republican and Democratic presidential nominating contests start in February, leading to national party conventions in the U.S. presidential election next November. International agencies are condemning a new public campaign by Hungary they say promotes intolerance and fear and fuels xenophobia against refugees and migrants. The UN Refugee Agency, the Council of Europe, and the Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights are urging the Hungarian government to end these policies. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Countries increasingly are closing their doors to asylum seekers and migrants. The UN Refugee Agency says it is extremely worried. Hungary's newly launched anti-refugee campaign is stoking fear in the hearts of many and will encourage more governments to turn away people fleeing persecution and war. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler tells VOA the campaign portrays those fleeing in fear of their lives as criminals, invaders, and terrorists based on their religious beliefs and places of origin.
This latest campaign, which graphically shows images that are designed to promote fear in the viewers, fear of foreigners and refugees, it's very worrying. And we fear that in many parts of Europe, the political debate tends to go to populist statements, to appeals to fear and to hatred of foreigners that are not constructive.
Most of the refugees arriving in Europe are from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, all primarily Muslim countries. Several European countries, including Hungary, have said they prefer to accept Christian refugees over Muslims. Spindler says the Hungarian government also is using physical means to deter refugees from entering the country. These include building barbed wire fences and detaining people for lengthy periods of time. He says Hungary is part of the common European system, and as such, it should uphold common European values of tolerance and respect for human rights. He says the country's leaders should deal with refugees in a responsible, not punitive way. He says nearly 1 million people have arrived in Europe by sea this year. Spindler says the UNHCR is advocating for a fairer distribution of refugees and asylum seekers so the impact is shared equitably throughout the European Union. He says Hungary should share in this process. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Millions of dollars and thousands of lives could be saved by overhauling the way energy is provided to refugee camps. Efforts are underway to generate private sector interest in bringing new technologies to some of the world's most desperate people. Henry Ridgewell has details.
The global displacement of people has reached its highest ever level. According to the United Nations, 59.5 million people have been forced to leave their homes. Refugee camps are swelling in size, and the resources to keep them running are often scarce. The newly formed Moving Energy Initiative, a collaboration between humanitarian organizations, is calling for an overhaul in the way energy is supplied and used in camps. Glada Lahn is from British policy group Chatham House, which is part of the initiative.
We believe there's huge opportunity to both improve the lives and livelihoods of these very vulnerable people and also help to save money over the long term.
The most recent electricity bill for Jordan's Za'atari camp on the Syrian border came to $8.7 million, forcing the UN to cut improvised connections. But 90% of people living in camps have no access to electricity. 80% rely on firewood for cooking.
Given more efficient cook stoves and solar lanterns, for instance, there could be a saving, we estimated, at $323 million per year, which would pay off the initial investment fairly quickly. There are even better solutions once you start involving solar or solar hybrid mini grids, other forms of renewable energy.
Researchers estimate that 20,000 refugees die prematurely every year due to the pollution from indoor fires for cooking. Gathering the fuel can also be dangerous, especially for women.
Women don't want to leave the tent or the hut at night time. If there's no lighting, when they do, they're at risk of accidents and also attacks. Similarly, we heard so many cases of women and girls leaving the camps to collect firewood and being at risk from rape and other types of attack.
Lahn says host countries are often reluctant to provide facilities that appear permanent, but researchers say that using green technologies could save lives and radically improve living standards for the world's most vulnerable people. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Coming up, what your brain is saying about the Bah Humbug Syndrome at Christmas. This is VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. Sepp Blatter, the embattled president of World Football governing body FIFA, is vowing to fight his 8-year ban from all football-related activities. He made the vow at a Monday news conference in Switzerland shortly after FIFA's ethics committee imposed the ban on him and the head of European football, Michel Platini. FIFA penalized the pair for involvement in an unauthorized payment of $2 million by Blatter to Platini in 2011. International Edition's Michael Lippin spoke with David Larkin, an international attorney specializing in sport law, about that transaction and why FIFA ruled it was a conflict of interest.
Well, what you have is the allegation is that basically this is a payment that was never recorded in FIFA's account. And so the head of audit compliance, Domenico Scala, said that it really, the question was whether this was a falsification of the financial matters at FIFA, because basically you had two executive committee members aware of a $2 million liability, and yet that was allegedly never recorded in FIFA's account. If that's the case, then Mr. Scala raised a very valid point as to whether this is a falsification of the accounts.
Why should fans of international soccer be concerned about that kind of financial arrangement?
Well, because you have, any time you're having a payment that's paid 9 years later, that's a red flag. That to date, we really haven't seen any evidence that it was recorded anywhere. That's another red flag. But I mean, this goes along the lines with everything else we've seen, that this is an organization with leaders who do not feel that they owe fans or football accountability for the financial transactions that they engage in. Whether this, you know, transaction was valid or invalid, what we have is a very suspicious circumstances surrounding 2 million Swiss francs paid 9 years after the obligation was incurred. And the only word we have from either of the people involved is an oral agreement. That should trouble anyone.
Well, we did hear Sepp Blatter tell the media that he's going to appeal this decision by the Ethics Committee to FIFA's Appeals Committee and maybe even the Court of Arbitration for Sport in Lausanne. What chances of success do you think he has?
Well, I think at the Appeal Committee, I don't see anything really changing with the FIFA Appeal Committee. At CAF, I think that there is a chance that this may be overturned or
and,
not, depending on the evidence.
By CAS, you mean the Court of Arbitration for Sport?
Yes. But the problem is that the Court of Arbitration for Sport is an entity that has a lot of conflicts of interest, in my opinion. And so it's not like we have a real independent review. These are people in sport reviewing matters. And I got to be honest, as an attorney, there are clearly systemic problems with that organization as outlined in the recent Pechstein decision by the German court. So, you know, the idea that we have this independent sport justice system that works well or efficiently is false. There's a lot of problems to it, and so I think there's a lot of room for this to run going forward in the future.
That's David Larkin, an international attorney specializing in sport law based in Washington. He was talking with International Edition's Michael Lippin. For some people, Christmas is a magical time of year filled with warmth, excitement, and generosity. For others, Christmas time carries no particular significance, in some cases even causing annoyance or despair. Researchers have located the source of the feelings of Christmas joy or disgust to a number of regions in the brain. VOA's Jessica Berman explains.
Danish researchers believe they've traced the Christmas spirit, either feelings of warmth and joy or what they playfully call the Bah humbug syndrome, to a number of areas of the brain. They assembled two groups of volunteers. One group, which they called the Christmas group, comprised 10 ethnic Danes who celebrate Christmas. The second non-Christmas group was made up of 10 people, including individuals of Pakistani, Iraqi, Indian, and Turkish descent, with no tradition of celebrating the holiday. Using high-tech fMRI imaging, researchers scanned the brains of all of the subjects while showing them both holiday-inspired images and ordinary ones. In the first group, a Christmas spirit network appeared, five areas of the brain that lit up. That neural activity is associated with spirituality, experiencing emotions shared by other people, and mouth actions suggesting pleasure in eating meals with loved ones. Similar responses were not seen in the non-Christmas group. Brian Haddock is a medical physicist at a hospital affiliated with Copenhagen University.
When you have a reaction to Christmas and decorations around you and the scenery you're looking at, there definitely is something that happens. We're able to catch it on scanner that there is something that goes on in the brain when it's, you know, when you see something that puts you in the Christmas mood.
The findings were published in the British Medical Journal. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
You don't have to reside in a galaxy far, far away to know there is another installment of the Star Wars franchise in movie theaters, Star Wars: The Force Awakens. You may also be familiar or own some of the multitude of Star Wars memorabilia that's been produced over the past four decades. International Business Times reporter Oriana Schwent talked with International Edition's Jim Stevenson about some of the more unusual items.
Oh, definitely. Everything from coffee creamer, if you want a little Chewbacca in the morning, I guess, to, you know, jewelry, to, you know, Crocs with the cast's face on them.
What are some of the more unusual things that you have seen that carry the Star Wars logo?
I will say the Crocs were a little surprising. I mean, you expect, you know, kids, they love anything with Star Wars, you know, that's fine, cereal, whatever. But adult Crocs with, you know, the cast on them is a little weird to me.
Well, I'm sure if you dress up and go to the movie, that might be appropriate.
Sure, but that's, you know, $50 is a lot for a one-time thing.
Well, it might replace the bedroom slippers.
Perhaps. I don't own a pair myself, but I do hear they're quite comfortable. Or, you know, maybe you're a fry cook and you just want to show your support. Or maybe they, you know, put a little force in your life.
The coffee creamer is an interesting one. Tell me a little bit about that.
Nestle has five special Star Wars-themed Coffee Mate flavors. Really, it's just the packaging, but it's, you know, it's R2-D2, it's C-3PO, it's Darth Vader and Boba Fett and Chewbacca. But what's interesting to me is it's all characters from the old Star Wars movie. None of the new guys made the cut. You don't see BB-8 there, which, you know, I can understand why. There's a lot of nostalgia out there, and you want to sort of play to that, and that makes sense.
And maybe some brand familiarization, and, well, they learned the fact that you can package it five different ways to sell perhaps five times as much.
Hey, here's hoping. Although, for, you know, it's interesting. I was talking to some marketing folks about this, and for them, really, it's just about, it's mostly about cutting through the clutter that's out there, especially during the holiday season. You're inundated with ads from everyone and everything. And, you know, especially in the case of something like, there's a few Dodge commercials out there that use some clips from the film and specifically the music, that classic John Williams score. You know, you might just be putzing around the house, but you hear that and you start to pay attention. So really, that's the upside for them. No one's going to say no to higher sales if that happens. But really, it's about getting people to pay attention again.
What are some of the other things that you have found that we potentially can take home with us?
CoverGirl has several different themes of makeup lines that you can sort of collect and use. There's a Stormtrooper-themed line. There's Jedi-themed line. There's droid. And the models that they depict have, like, it's like Queen Amidala from the Star Wars prequels. That might be a little ill-advised making us remember that. But it does look cool if it's a little labor-intensive, perhaps. But it's not too bad. And there's also Star Wars charms from Kay Jeweler, which wants you to choose the light or dark side through your jewelry, which is certainly feels a little trivial. I don't, maybe I'm just a horrible cynic.
International Business Times reporter Oriana Schwint. That's it for this edition of International Edition. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The El Niño phenomenon has significantly impacted weather patterns in Ethiopia this year, limiting agricultural production, straining livelihoods, and exacerbating food insecurity among vulnerable households. As El Niño continues into 2016, Ethiopia is likely to experience both prolonged drought and intense flooding that will further deteriorate conditions. The projected levels of need for relief food assistance in Ethiopia have grown from 2.9 million people in early 2015 to 10.2 million people as of December 11th. Approximately 5.8 million people will need clean water. To address this humanitarian crisis, the United States announced an additional $88 million in humanitarian assistance to increase funding for nutrition, food, water, sanitation, and hygiene support. With this new assistance, USAID will scale up rapid response systems for nutrition and water and support partners to jumpstart pipelines of relief supplies. This follows the release of the humanitarian requirements document on December 11th, to which the United States immediately responded and released approximately 116,460 metric tons of food assistance. USAID is currently supporting approximately 3.9 million Ethiopians and refugees with relief food assistance. Additionally, USAID provides approximately $100 million annually in support of the Productive Safety Net program, which the government of Ethiopia has expanded to reach nearly 8 million of the most chronically food insecure. Through the provision of regular food and cash transfers, households can protect critical assets such as livestock during these times of crisis. Ethiopia is now better able to cope with such crises due to improved tracking of the progression of El Niño and its impact, the establishment of the Productive Safety Net program, and serious engagement by the government of Ethiopia to analyze and respond to the ongoing crisis exacerbated by El Niño. USAID's resilience investments, including efforts to safeguard livelihood assets and better manage natural resources, are also helping the most vulnerable Ethiopian households cope with the impacts of El Niño. Nevertheless, These are the driest conditions ever recorded in parts of Ethiopia, and there is an urgent need for all donors to step up and do what they can. The United States will continue to work with the government of Ethiopia and its international partners to provide humanitarian relief and adapt development efforts to help meet the immediate needs of those most impacted by El Nino, help mitigate the impact of the drought, and speed recovery.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. It's